This is the podcast ICU Rounds. My name is Dr. Jeffrey Guy. I'm an associate professor of surgery and director of the Burn Center at the Vanderbilt University School of Medicine in Nashville, Tennessee. Hello, welcome back to ICU Rounds. I get a lot of requests to do podcasts and discussions on various elements of fluid resuscitation. What are the different types of fluid compartments? What are the different types of fluids? What is all this stuff that we're hearing about? Limited resuscitations, different types of blood transfusion strategies, giving what we call one-to-one blood component therapy. About a year ago, I did a podcast interview with a colleague and a dear friend of mine, Dr. Brian Cotton, on another podcast called MedTalk Network, and you can find that on www.medtalknetwork.com. This interview was done several months ago. Dr. Brian Cotton, at that point, he was on faculty here at Vanderbilt University School of Medicine. As I've said, he recently took a job, a wonderful job, at the University of Texas, Houston, and he will be successful there, I'm sure more successful there than he has been even at Vanderbilt. For those of you at UT Houston, you're going to be very blessed with a very gifted educator, researcher, and clinician, and he's a very dear friend of mine. So without any further ado, I want to share this interview that I did last year with Dr. Brian Cotton, both as an educational tool for our listeners, but also as a way of kind of honoring my friend. I hope you enjoy this.
He complained of rapidly progressing vision loss.
ECG was done, which showed T-wave inversions in multiple leads.
Today's medical world is rapidly changing. This is a MedTalk Network podcast from the online network for medical professionals.
His blood pressure was 135 over 99.
Thoughtful experts offer a unique perspective on complex medical topics that will make a difference in the way you practice medicine.
Good morning, afternoon, or evening. Maybe it's even in the middle of the night, depending on where you are as you're listening. I'm Dr. Jeffrey Guy. I'm an associate professor of surgery and director of the Vanderbilt Regional Burn Center. Welcome to Surgery ICU Rounds. Today we're going to be talking about changes in fluid and blood resuscitation in the critically injured patient. And I'm lucky to have as a guest today on our program Dr. Brian Cotton. Dr. Cotton is a specialist in emergency general surgery, trauma surgery, and surgical critical care. He is currently assistant professor of surgery in the Division of Trauma and Emergency Surgery and the director of the surgical critical care at the Tennessee Valley VA Medical Center, both located in Nashville, Tennessee. He's a member of the Association for Academic Surgery, the Society for Critical Care Medicine, and the American College of Surgeons, the American Association for the Surgery of Trauma, and the Eastern Association of Surgery of Trauma. In the last 4 years, Dr. Cotton has kept himself busy. He's authored 25 papers, 9 book chapters, and has delivered approximately 25 invited lectures. His research focuses primarily on resuscitation of early hemorrhage, hyperadrenergic states following head injury, and delirium in the surgical intensive care unit. Brian, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you, Jeff.
You've written some pretty interesting stuff over the past year that has been well lauded in the literature as well as at meetings, particularly what I'm thinking about is the article that you wrote in Shock that was the lead article back in December, where you kind of looked at where we've been and where we're at and perhaps where we should be going in fluid resuscitation. I'm just curious as to what you think we're doing right and what do you think we're doing wrong?
That's a good question. To better understand where we are now, I think, and how we've gotten here, it's important to look back at the road traveled to get us to where we are, the fluid resuscitation state. You know, you probably recall back in your residency the carefully titrated fluids and the small boluses given for patients based on physiology such as tachycardia, lower blood pressure, low urine output, and the, you know, very strict INOs that were recorded in these patients. But during the early portion of the 90s and even some of the late 80s, we had this explosion in surgical critical care and trauma where a lot of invasive lines were going in, not only just arterial lines, but central lines, PA catheters, many times in the pre-hospital setting, some of these things. And we started this explosion of bolusing trauma patients in the bay, bolusing them in the pre-hospital setting, and basically forgetting where ATLS had brought us. And then even a more concerning thing is that even though we were trying to titrate these fluids to their effect, or at least what we thought we could get away with, it ended up being extrapolated to patients that were not necessarily the young, healthy trauma patient that could handle it. And if you, you know, if you look back, it goes back even to the 50s and 60s where we are today, which was, you know, carefully titrated fluid volumes coming out of Shires and Moore and colleagues looking at this. And then the big change, I think, as far as the paradigm, came from probably like Shoemaker and colleagues in the early 80s when they started the concept of the supernormal resuscitation. And prior to that, it had been very much a moderation is king, which is actually what it elicited the moderation editorial by both Moore and Shires. And what that Shoemaker article did was pushing the supernormal resuscitation to be almost a norm. And if your patient didn't tolerate that supernormal resuscitation, it was at least felt that they would die. And if they didn't, and if you didn't deliver it, you were committing malpractice. Well, a very interesting thing historically is about the same time, Harlan Stone and colleagues down in Atlanta came up with this, you know, very novel concept of an abbreviated laparotomy, what we call now as damage control or the open abdomen. And they were damage controlling patients based on the initial, you know, acidosis, hypothermia, and coagulopathy, which prior to instituting this type of process of damage control, although it was not called that at the time, they were able to actually do all the procedures and effectively kill the patient over that 8-hour period where they had basically taken care of everything and walked out of the patient with walked out of the OR with a patient that was not alive, although all their injuries were addressed. And then it wasn't until, you know, probably 1993 when Rotondo and colleagues at Penn actually came up with the name damage control, which stuck a little bit more, I think, maybe in the psyche or the machismo world of trauma. And they actually were showing that patients undergoing this damage control concept had a significantly better survival than those getting everything addressed at once. And so about this time, they were leaving their bellies open for a good reason so that they could correct that lethal triad of coagulopathy, hypothermia, acidosis. And at this same time, you've got this concept or this push to have this supernormal resuscitation from Shoemaker, and we end up with all these open abdomens and all this abdominal compartment syndrome that we're kind of just two paths crossing in the night, and we don't put two and two together. And soon enough, the open abdomen became an acceptable option because we were treating abdominal compartment syndrome, which was killing people as well. And the open abdomen was now seen as fashionable because of damage control surgery. But unfortunately, that aggressive resuscitation approach and the subsequent development of ACS continues to this day. And unfortunately, or fortunately, it's getting a little bit less intense as far as the amount of it. And I think some of the swing back towards the normal resuscitation or the more reasonable moderation of fluids has really come out in the last probably 5 years, and a lot of that, unfortunately, being spurred by the Iraq and Afghanistan conflicts. But we've seen how they are managing their soldiers over there, and how much better their survival is, and how they're able to extricate these patients from these hostile settings with basically no IV fluid, maybe an IV or an intraosseous line, and just basically titrating fluids to effect just to keep them awake and maybe with a palpable pulse. And so I think that's been a huge, you know, back and forth change in the last 50 years as far as surgery and trauma have gone as far as the fluid resuscitation. So I think we've definitely swung our paradigm, our pendulum back to where it ought to be, which is what Moore and Shires initially had really sought out, which was moderation.
You know, it's interesting that you talk about that, because when the Maddox group, and I, my apologies to the first author, but it'll always refer to the Maddox.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah.
But that was in almost 14 years ago that they published the idea of fluid conservation or not resuscitating the penetrating trauma. And that was really viewed then as, wow, this is really heretical and progressive. But when you look back historically, Moss wrote, I believe, in like 1908 or 1910 in the Journal of the American Medical Association, basically the same thing, is to not resuscitate somebody with penetrating trauma. Now, you went back in the 60s, and you're talking about Dr. Shires. For our listeners who may not be aware of that landmark research by Dr. Shires and his dogs that he resuscitated, can you go back to what Dr. Shires found when he hemorrhaged dogs and versus hemorrhaging dogs who got shed blood alone versus shed blood with a crystalloid?
What he was finding is that some of the patients that were actually getting the crystalloid with the blood seemed to be doing better versus hemorrhaging, you know, their survival was improved versus those who were just getting blood alone. And I don't think, you know, that kind of caught on, at least in the dog model, that they ended up translating into trauma and then, unfortunately, even to some of the burn patients.
And the damage control, I mean, it seemed like in the early 90s where damage control kind of came in vogue, is that we would leave a patient open, even in the operating room, not even take them out of the operating room and resuscitate them there in the theater with, you know, trying to get their coagulopathy and rewarming them and finishing the definitive operation hours later. And it seems that's kind of migrated too to, we kind of stuff them with sponges and towel clip them or put an ioban on them and bring them back in sunlight. Do you think that changes the physiology at all by waiting?
Well, by waiting, I mean, that was the initial concept, or at least the initial thing that both Harlan Stone and colleagues found, as well as the group in Pennsylvania, which was correcting them in their acidosis, their hypothermia, and their coagulopathy, and then returning when the patient's physiology had corrected, not just doing it real time. And, you know, whether you do it in a 3 hours, you know, 6 hours, 12 hours, no one's really giving you a hardcore time estimate, but it appears that those who resuscitate a little bit more slowly, perhaps over the course of a 24-hour, and are taken back in a very, you know, during the light of day, like you said, with the A-team operating, with the fresh team going back, because you've already, if you think about it, and you know this as well, you've already addressed the life-threatening injuries, the soil, the contamination, the things that are going to kill that patient you've already dealt with in that initial operation. The other things of bowel continuity, abdominal wall closure, things like that can be revised afterwards. And again, it's a dynamic process. I mean, during this resuscitation, like you're talking about, during what we call phase two of damage control, you're going to IR if you need to embolize parts of the liver. You're still getting workups for head injuries, putting in ICP monitors, doing other things that are going to correct this patient to get them in that door-to-door fashion corrected and ready for prime time for the team to take back over that patient, take that patient back to the operating room and finish the case that was initially hoped to have started. And I think one of the big differences in different training programs or different mindsets, especially now, it's that we're going in understanding we're going to leave this patient open because they're coming in an extremis. We're not going to allow ourselves to get taken away by the beauty of the procedure we're doing, by the blood in our face, by the contamination, by the level of injuries. We're going to focus on what's killing that patient, and we're going to get them out and get them to a safer, happier place, which is usually where we're controlling, which is in the critical care unit versus the operating theater, which, like you mentioned earlier, is probably fine as long as you're really, truly directing that patient's care and truly monitoring the resuscitation. But so often when that ether screen goes up, there's a separation of church and state there and a complete separation of the minds, and we don't communicate as well. And I think when you've got that damage control concept and you get back and it's your team on your turf back in the ICU, I think that we communicate amongst ourselves better than we do, unfortunately, during the operating room.
Well, I want to ask you, who's the church and who's the state on the other side of the ether screen? You did mention, you know, we've learned quite a bit about our trauma colleagues serving in the military about how they're taking care of war combat injuries. And the Journal of Trauma, it was 2003 or 2004, had a whole supplement on the military strategy to resuscitation. And as you point out, they walk up to somebody, and if they're mentating, they're fine. If they've got a radial pulse, they're fine, and they won't even start IVs. Aside from that, though, we've also learned that they're using different types of IV fluids, and the Institute of Medicine has kind of signed off that maybe we're not even using the right strategy. You know, maybe we're giving too much IV fluid, but maybe we're not even giving the right IV fluid. What are your thoughts on that?
That's a very good point. The, you know, like you mentioned, they're bringing up this one-to-one-to-one resuscitation concept in the presence of, again, a permissive hypotension, titrated like what you were talking about with the physiology, mental status, and not just based on a hardcore blood pressure. But as far as the fluids, there are ongoing research as far as what fluid is best, what fluid is king. And I think part of the necessity early on, it just kind of one of those random occurrences that happened in the military out of necessity, which was they needed to carry a smaller, more concentrated bag of fluid. They couldn't carry these big liters of normal saline or lactate or ringers in their bags, these special forces people, and they were forced to carry these 100, 250 ml bags of hypertonic saline and things like that. And what we found is that those fluids at least do a good of a job, if not better, in some of these hemorrhagic shock states. It's still up for debate as far as maybe how good they are when it comes to something along the lines of head injury, although they definitely can have their place in a head injury management. But in a hemorrhagic shock model and in a hemorrhagic shock setting, such as in a penetrating trauma civilian setting or military, it seems to have at least as good of an experience, if not better. And again, I think a lot of that, look as closely at some of those studies, is a lot of it's patient selection. But, I mean, the hypertonic saline has definitely caught on, and it actually, when we did the EAST guidelines, we just finished the presenting those at the Eastern Association for Surgery Trauma, the EAST guidelines on pre-hospital resuscitation. Unfortunately, there was not enough data to give a hard stance on what exactly we should be doing as far as which fluid choice, but I can tell you that there was a definite level of data in animal models and in some humans that hypertonic saline is probably a superior fluid.
Yeah, it's interesting that we've learned in the treatment of acute lung injury or ARDS that how we ventilated the patients for the past 15 or 20 years is perhaps pro-inflammatory. We're actually perhaps hurting people in our treatment as much as we are trying to help them. And it seems interesting that, you know, when you look at the different isomers of latitudinated ringers, that, you know, some of the fluids in the way we resuscitate it may be pro-inflammatory itself, and maybe we need to take a step back. You mentioned one-to-one-to-one transfusion practices. This was something that the military seems to have grasped on quite a bit. It's starting to, we're seeing it more on the civilian side. Share more about that with me.
Sure. Real quick before I answer that, the hypertonic, you're absolutely right. These things, not just do they mobilize in, you know, cellular water and normalizing cell volume, but they actually seem to be, and this comes out of Marty Schreiber's experience, a friend of mine at Portland, Oregon, who has done a lot of work, mostly, again, animal models, where and in some human serum type studies, has actually shown a significant amount of inflammatory marker or decrease in inflammatory markers when you're utilizing hypertonic saline and solutions such as this versus the traditional lactated ringers and or normal saline or even other solutions. The hypertonic, again, definitely seems to have some level of attenuation of some of that hyperdynamic response and some of that hyperinflammatory response. But as far as the one-to-one goes, the military and their damage control resuscitation, which is what they've been have been calling it, has come across what they feel, based on their literature and based on some of the civilian literature, is a better model of resuscitation. And if you think about it, it's, I'm not going to say it's a no-brainer, but it almost is. One-to-one-to-one most reasonably approximates whole blood. And what they found...
Yeah, the one-to-one-to-one, since we didn't specify that, what does that mean to somebody who's not familiar with that?
Sure. So one unit. So basically, you know, the traditional, at least when I was trained, you know, you had to give like 10 units of packed red blood cells before you even thought about FFP, and then only if the INR was disturbed. Platelets almost never happened. Versus now, you know, they've taken this to where the soldier gets one unit of blood. Well, at the same time, they're getting a unit of thawed plasma, and they're getting a pack of platelets at the same time. And this continues until the surgeon and the anesthesiologist think that they've achieved both medical and surgical hemostasis. And this is much higher in any than any, you know, as far as ratios go, than anything we'd even thought about or even considered. In fact, it's even more aggressive than some of the other civilian setting transfusion ratios that are out there. But in doing it, they're approximating whole blood, and both the whole blood that they've transfused, because they have obviously a nice, clean, pre-screened tap of whole blood volunteers over there real-time to actually use it. It's much more difficult to pull off in a civilian setting. But they're using this whole blood and getting about the same outcomes as they're getting with this one-to-one-to-one. And in doing this, they're obviously able to partition out the products a little bit better and utilize them a little more economically and be able to translate that more into the civilian setting where whole blood, again, is very difficult to get and process real-time for trauma centers. And again, their experience in survival has been impressive with or without adjuncts such as Factor 7. Just with that whole blood ratio and process alone, they've been getting some pretty impressive numbers in reduction and mortality versus what is expected.
And is that something that we should be applying in a civilian setting? I mean, some would argue, well, the military, you know, they're seeing 30% mortality rates. It's all penetrating. They have real logistical issues. We have essentially limitless blood banks. So, you know, maybe what works downrange in a military trauma situation, maybe we shouldn't apply that in a civilian trauma situation.
No, I think it's a great point as well. But if you think about it, the majority of deaths from trauma occur in the first few hours, And if you look at the causes of it, central nervous system injury is number one. But very close behind it, as far as causes of death, is hemorrhage in those first few hours after arrival at the trauma center. In fact, once you actually get to the operating room, 80% of deaths are due to exsanguination. And in the first 24 hours, 50% of deaths are due to exsanguinating hemorrhage. And if you think about it on another level, you know, we're only, you know, central nervous system interventions, as much as we like to think that how much little interventions here and there and studies here and there have actually helped brain injury. In the last 10 years, you and I both have looked at head injury outcomes, and they haven't been that much improved. Spinal cord injury has not been that much improved. We have something that can rapidly either control exsanguination or even prevent it, that hemorrhagic coagulopathy, real time. I think we'd be foolish not to, to at least try and engage it. And the military has done it, and they've done it effectively. And now civilian settings and civilian centers have actually picked up on that. Many of them in a one-to-one ratio, such as places in Houston and in Charity Hospital in New Orleans, whereas other centers, such as at Vanderbilt and in a few other places, have gone in a little bit less aggressive fashion, but much more aggressive than in the past, such as, you know, maybe three, for every 3 units of blood, they're not getting 3 units of plasma, but they're getting 2. For every, you know, 5 units of blood, maybe they're not getting 5 packs of platelets, but they're getting 1 or 2 packs of platelets. So it's a much more aggressive than at least historically, and the outcomes seem to be already improved real-time in the civilian setting. And again, I think that's even more impressive when you're doing it with or without factor 7 or other clotting factors and things, or hemostatic agents, when you're seeing these outcomes, which are dramatically changed since the Iraq and Afghanistan conflicts have occurred, and we've adopted some of these principles that the military has brought on, because we are seeing quite a significant amount of penetrating trauma in the U.S., as well as some significant blunt trauma that just gets beyond our blood bank's ability to keep up. It becomes a logistic nightmare of actually trying to, you know, collaborate with them, collaborate with anesthesia on the other side of the screen to get the blood products delivered and get it in this ratio that we want without going through a significant amount of hurdles, which by the time we get labs back and we actually have a conversation with the colleague on the other side, it's too late. You know, those labs are old, the conversation's old, and the patient's exsanguinated.
Well, Dr. Cotton, I really wanted to thank you for joining me today. You certainly have given us a lot to think about, and certainly a topic that's right on the razor's edge about what's provocative, not only in trauma surgery, but also in critical care. We're wrapping it up now for this edition of Surgery ICU Rounds, and special thanks goes to my guest, Dr. Brian Cotton, Assistant Professor of Surgery in the Department of Surgery in the Division of Trauma Emergency Surgery and Critical Care at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee. Thank you. Bye-bye.
So there you have it. That is an interview with Dr. Brian Cotton that has appeared on the MedTalk Network podcast, ICU Rounds. You can get further podcasts from MedTalk. That is copyrighted material, and I'm certainly sure they would appreciate it if you visited their site. And that's on www.medtalknetwork.com. Other things going on here at ICU Rounds, if you enjoy the content we're giving you, by all means, please visit the iTunes site and give some feedback. We appreciate that. Also, we have a site on Facebook, and the intent of that site is to allow exchange and dialogue and questions among our various listeners. It's my opinion that a lot of times people learn more from themselves than they do any one person instructing, in my opinion, is true even with the podcast. So if you've got ideas about programs, different opinions on what we're saying and we're like to discuss with various peers, by all means, check out that on Facebook. It's on ICU Rounds as a member group. Additionally, check out our other content on the internet. The podcast, Pharmacology for the Pre-Hospital Professional, also available free on iTunes. If you are a pre-hospital professional, this is right up your alley. If you're not a pre-hospital professional, it's my opinion that you will certainly learn a lot from this podcast, and I'm probably going to do some posting of those podcasts on this site as well. I learned a great deal writing that textbook, and there are a lot of medications and concepts on there that'll value any provider in the ICU or otherwise. Additionally, you can get a hold of me through my website, burndoc.com. Thanks for listening to ICU Rounds. My name is Jeffrey Guy. Have a great day.